Ravner, NPR News, Washington.
At least two people have been killed in an earthquake that struck this morning off the coast of Honduras. Injuries are reported, though how many people have been hurt is not confirmed. Houses were toppled in Honduras and Belize as residents ran from their homes in much of Central America. Terrorist attacks have shattered the peace in the Pakistani city of Peshawar today. A suspected suicide attack at a police checkpoint just outside the city is under investigation. At least five people were killed in that. And a series of explosions in a market area in the city has killed at least six people. These attacks come a day after a suicide bomb and gun attack in the city of Lahore killed more than two dozen and injured many more. The Taliban took responsibility. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both hours of Focus 580 come to you from the archives. In hour number one, we'll feature an interview that we first broadcast in March with journalist Tom Ricks, who has written two very influential and widely read books about the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Back in March, we talked about his most recent. It's titled The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. So as you listen this morning, do keep in mind that today on Focus 580, we'll not be taking calls. We have a healthcare topic for you this morning, something that we've done off and on quite a few years now, and generally with the same guy who is here sitting with me this morning. His name is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist, which means he's a doctor who specializes in the foot and the ankle, nothing above that. And from time to time here now, over lo these many years, he's been here to talk a little bit about foot health and answer questions. And that is what we will do. Every once in a while, we pick a particular body part and talk about that. We have some people who are more generalist who deal with everything, but specifically. Well, we got started there on the wrong program, but I think we got the right one now. So again, this is a show first broadcast in March, conversation with journalist Tom Ricks, author of the book The Gamble. Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Since early 2007, a new military order has directed American strategy in Iraq. And at the center is General David Petraeus and a small group of officers that form his immediate close circle. This was not a policy that was developed in the White House. In fact, what the White House wanted to happen in Iraq was something very different. It's a policy that in many ways has been successful, and yet the long-term future of Iraq is still in doubt. There are some people, in fact, who argue that we may only be at the halfway point in this war and that American troops will be in Iraq for many years to come. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Thomas Ricks. He is the senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, where he's covered the U.S. military since 2000. Perhaps people will know him for his book Fiasco. That was published in 2006. The book looked at the many mistakes made by the Bush administration in Iraq. His new book, which is just recently out, is titled The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. It is published by Penguin Press, and it looks at the change in tactics adopted by a new set of commanders headed by General Petraeus. This is the policy commonly referred to as the surge, and did indeed involve sending more troops into Iraq, although there is more to it than that, and we'll be talking about that in this hour of the show as we talk with Thomas Ricks. Until the end of 1999, he also reported on defense issues at the Wall Street Journal, where he worked for 17 years. He was a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting, and he's reported on the U.S. military activities in a lot of places around the world: Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments so we can get in as many as possible, but people are certainly welcome to call. 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. Mr. Ricks, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
I think it's probably the place to start is to talk about the surge. And as I said, I'm sure one thing people understand about it, maybe the only thing they really understand about it, was that it did involve sending more troops. But that was perhaps not the most important thing to know about the surge. In essentially, what was the idea behind this change in policy that General Petraeus brought to Iraq?
The core idea was to protect Iraqi civilians and to make that the top priority for the U.S. mission. Until Petraeus and General Odierno took over in Iraq at the beginning of 2007, the U.S. mission officially stated the number one priority was transition to Iraqi forces, that is, hand the ball over to Iraqi army and police. And Petraeus and Odierno said, you know, Iraq is descending into a civil war. We're losing this thing. We need a different approach. So they said, you've got to protect the people. Well, to do that, you need to move the troops off those big bases and into little outposts across Baghdad and around it. The feeling was, or the conclusion was, if you're on patrol in a neighborhood 1 hour a day, then somebody else controls it the other 23 hours a day. So move into outposts, be there 24 hours a day, get a better sense of the neighborhood, get a feeling of what's normal and what's abnormal, and eventually people will also start talking to you. In order to do that, to get more troops out there, to get troops into the neighborhoods, you needed more troops. It's very troop-intensive. And that was the key to the surge, not the idea of let's simply put more troops in Iraq and see what happens.
And I think that one of the things that you have done with this book, and I know in talking about it, is I think that you have wanted to make sure that people understood that a good bit of the credit here, for at least for the idea, should go to General Odierno, someone who previously had been much criticized for his conduct of the war in Iraq. I think, in fact, you were among the critics. And yet, in this particular case, it seems that you'd have to, if one said, well, really, whose idea was this? I think you'd have to say it was his.
He really pushed hard for it. He was the only person in the chain of command to support the idea of the surge. His boss, General Casey, their boss, General Abizaid, and the top officer in the U.S. military, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Pace, all were opposed to it, as were the chiefs of the services. What Odierno did was kind of extraordinary. He did an end run around the chain of command and basically talked directly to the White House about doing this. using the services of an old mentor of his, General Jack Keane, now retired. And the two of them essentially sold the idea directly to President Bush.
And this, and in spite of what the White House, anybody in the White House, the president, anybody else might have said, this certainly idea didn't come from the White House. And initially, the orders that came down to General Odierno were, in fact, to do something completely different.
Yeah, I actually reprinted those orders at the end of the book just because I found them so extraordinary. The orders he's given in December 06 when he arrives in Iraq are basically get out of the cities, let the Iraqis have their fight, and hunker down. And over the next 2 months, he rewrote those orders. So when General Petraeus arrived, the orders that Odierno presented to him said, I want to move into the cities. I want to intervene in the violence. I want to stop the violence. And I think I need to put American troops on the front line to do that.
And now, also, before Petraeus got to Iraq, he and some other people were starting to think about and try to overhaul the Army's policy on dealing with insurgency. In what way did Petraeus play into this, and what was his part? In what way was he important in making this happen?
I think Petraeus did two really important things. The first is, before he got to Iraq, as you say, he oversaw the writing of this manual on counterinsurgency. No great new ideas, but really pulling together all the classic theory about how to do this, which is something the U.S. military had genuinely been ignorant of when it arrived in Iraq and for the first 4 years of the occupation. How do you protect the people? The U.S. military had gone in very focused on killing and capturing the enemy. And the manual that Petraeus and others produced said, no, ignore the enemy. Focus on the people. Your job is to make the enemy irrelevant. And the ideal thing is to actually bring the enemy over to your side. Then when Petraeus arrives in Iraq, he forces this down the throats of a lot of unwilling parts of the U.S. Army in Iraq and said, no, we're all going to do this. And for the first time, really, in 2007, you have everybody who's fighting in Iraq on the same page, understanding what they were trying to do. So I would talk to platoon leaders and captains who were familiar with this new manual, who understood we're going to go out and protect the people.
Mm-hmm. I think that there, to the extent that it was successful, I think that some people would say that really was the important thing, particularly the United States in gaining the cooperation of, and some people would say co-opting of, some people would say simply flat-out paying. People formerly had been fighting against the United States to get them now to fight with the United States. Then many people have said, well, and perhaps this reflects the fact that so much attention was put on the sheer numbers that we were putting more troops in there. A lot of people have said, well, this is really that kind of thing, trying to build relationships with Iraqis and get them to turn from insurgents to partners, at least at the moment, with the United States. That was the thing that was really important.
It was extremely important. Petraeus did something very audacious, and you want audacity in your generals. He went to the Sunni insurgents and essentially put them on the American payroll. He paid them to stop fighting the Americans. This is something that really bothered the Baghdad government, which is dominated by Shiites. And it's not clear what the long-term effects will be. But in the short term, it really helped improve security. 100,000 insurgents and their buddies put on the payroll to the tune of $30 million a month. Now, if it had gone wrong somehow, and it could have easily done so, I think General Petraeus would have been blamed. But it was a good move on his part, at least in the short term.
Yeah. And early on, there was a lot of debate about whether or not this was a good policy. I think one of the things that you really want to get across in the book is that this period, particularly early on, involved some of the toughest fighting of the war. And no doubt that led some people to question the whole project.
Oh, yeah. The first 6 months of the surge, the spring and early summer of 2007, I think were the toughest part of the war, at least so far. Soldiers had to fight their way to these new outposts. I know one unit that encountered 50 buried bombs just moving to where it wanted to be. I know another unit that got in a firefight on the way to establish an outpost. And in the middle of the firefight, the platoon sergeant looked up and saw two Iraqi kids frozen with fear in the middle of the street. And he jumped up and grabbed a kid under each arm and then rolled to a corner and brought them to safety. Another soldier in that unit said later, that's when we won the firefight. It didn't matter whether we killed the insurgents who were shooting at us, but Iraqi people saw us protecting Iraqis, not just talking about it, but doing it. And that was significant because after 5 years of American sort of fouling up and messing up the situation, a lot of Iraqis didn't believe anything the Americans were telling them anymore, and action was needed. And that sort of action really brought home that the Americans were going to operate differently. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Thomas Ricks. He's Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent, where he's covered the U.S. military since 2000. Before that, for a number of years, he has had the same beat at the Wall Street Journal. His most recent book is The Gamble, which takes a look at this change in American policy in Iraq that has generally been called the surge. The book is published by the Penguin Press. Also, you might be interested in his previous book, Fiasco, that takes a look at how it is the U.S. got involved in the war. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Let's talk with someone who is listening. Our first caller is in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Yes. If the surge has been so effective, then why were the insurgents able to complete the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad? Here's a city that was about 50-50 Shi-Sunni before the surge. It had at one time had a fair population of Christians and in more remote times a Jewish population. Both are gone. I fail to see how the surge allowed this ethnic cleansing to be completed if it was so successful. And I would point out that over the rest of the country, there's been a similar displacement of Iraqi people. The Sunnis have moved out of Shi'i areas. The Shi'i have moved out of Sunni. This is a population which one of my Iraqi friends tells me, once had a 30% inter-ethnic marriage ratio. I doubt if that's happening much anymore.
I'm glad you asked this question. It's exactly the right question to pose. The answer is that the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad was largely completed by the time the Americans recognized what a disaster was on their hands in late 2006. And now what you have is essentially Sunni enclaves, a few of them left in western Baghdad, really protected by the Americans with walls erected around them as gated communities. But I want to emphasize the larger point also is, I think the surge was very effective in improving security in Baghdad and the surrounding area.
During the daytime.
Not generally. I mean, even now, it improved security overall, daytime and nighttime. But I think the surge failed. The purpose of the surge was not just to improve security, it was to lead to a political breakthrough, as that's what the President and the Secretary of Defense said at the time. And that didn't happen. All the basic questions that vexed Iraq before the surge are still there. How do you split up oil revenue? What's the relation between Shia and Sunni and Kurd? Will the government of Iraq be a loose confederation or a strong central government? None of these issues are resolved. All of them have led to violence in the past. All of them may still be solved violently. So we may be now not anywhere near the end of violence, but in a lull before the next phase of the war.
Yes.
You cut me off.
I did want to give the opportunity to the caller to follow up. However, I didn't really think it was fair for him to continue to interrupt the guest as he was trying to speak. I just want to be clear here that for people perhaps who haven't read your work or haven't heard you talking about it, that certainly you would not have argued that the war was a good idea. And in fact, you've said in very strong terms that you think that this may well be the decision to go into Iraq may well have been the worst decision in all of American history. And that's saying quite a lot.
I think the worst decision in the history of American foreign policy.
Ah.
I think there are some domestic things we could have handled better, such as slavery and the Native Americans. But on Iraq, yeah, I absolutely think this was a terrible decision, invading Iraq. I think it was the wrong thing to do. It was a distraction from the response to 9/11. It has cost us more than I think we even understand now. That said, I think we're also stuck in Iraq. I think that staying in Iraq is immoral, but I think that leaving Iraq would be more immoral. I don't think there are any moral solutions at this point, partly because it's all the fruit of the poison tree. The original sin was invading Iraq. Once you do that, none of the answers are going to be good. And while I've been critical of President Obama because I think there's some sleight of hand in how he's handled the future of the American military presence, I'm also very sympathetic to him. This guy has inherited the worst foreign policy situation that any new president has ever taken on. And the scary thing about that is it isn't even his number one problem, which is, of course, the economy.
And you have made this this observation, and that is based on the people that you've talked to, that we could continue to have troops for a very long time there. And in fact, there are some people who feel that we are really only at the halfway point in this war.
Well, look at what President Obama said the other day. His campaign promise had been, I'll take out a brigade a month for 16 months, and then we'll be out of Iraq. He comes into office, and the first big speech in Iraq, he says, well, actually, I'm not going to cut troops much this year. By the end of this year, we might be down to 130,000 troops. That's about the average for the whole time that we've been fighting there. Then he wants to get down to 35 to 50,000 by the following summer, August 2010. He might be able to do that, but then he's going to have those troops there for several years. Now, he says it'll be a non-combat mission. Well, the war doesn't end when you hang Mission Accomplished banner up on the USS Lincoln, nor does it end when another president says it's a non-combat mission. To my mind, the war ends when American troops stop dying. I was actually at the White House the day the president gave that speech, and I said to an American military official, will American troops still be dying in Iraq after August 2010? He said, yes, they will.
And I just one more thing, just because it's such a powerful quote. It's your last line in the book, and probably every review of the book that I've seen mentions it. This was a quote from Ryan Crocker. He's the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. He said, what was it that he said?
He said, the events for which the Iraq war will be remembered have not yet happened. And it's funny because he said it first to me in January 2008. Because I did a series of interviews in Iraq over a couple of years. And then in my last round of interviews in Baghdad in November, I said, look, Ambassador Crocker, you said this to me. Do you still believe it? Because if you still believe it, I'm going to make it the last line of the book. And he said, yeah, I totally believe it, even more strongly now. He wasn't predicting what's going to happen. He was just saying we don't yet have the prism, the framework through which we will come to understand and view this war. I mean, my thought, for example, is 5-10 years from now, the outcome might be a new Saddam Hussein, stronger, tougher, younger, smarter than Saddam Hussein, but non-democratic, anti-American, maybe allied to Tehran. And then we're going to say, well, no, it wasn't worth it to get rid of Saddam Hussein because we actually got somebody worse than him in place. And that's actually not the worst-case scenario. The worst-case scenario, of course, is a renewed civil war that turns into a regional war and really upsets the world economy even further because of the effect it has on oil prices.
All right, let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi. Mr. X, thank you. I read your book, Fiasco, and it was you're an excellent journalist and an astute scholar and a patriot in a way that's hard to understand until you read your books. But I was just going to ask you about the quote that you got from the ambassador, and it's really frightening to think that what has happened so far is not even what's going to define the war, and that's what's interesting about that. And have you thought about this over the years? What is it with the mentality of the West where we always feel like we have to intervene? And it's not, I mean, over the past the colonial experience from the 50s and like the 19th century, what is it about our psychology that says, we'll save everybody in Central Africa, or we won't save anybody in Central Africa, or let's go down in West Africa, or, hey, we should go to the Middle East and save these people? What about Vietnam? Because I spent 15 months on the Cambodian border 40 years ago, and when I left, I thought, years and years later, I thought, what the hell would we be doing there? But I'm just curious about what's this mentality that the West carries, that we're correct, we're right, we know everything, and let's straighten everything out. Could you address that issue if you've thought about it?
Sure. I've thought about Iraq every day for the last, I'd say, 6 or 7 years. And even now, it's not clear to me quite how and why we invaded Iraq. President Bush was never really clear about when the decision was made, for example, who was talked to, what the plan was. I think we were all knocked off balance by 9/11. I think the country politically lost its equilibrium, and that led, oddly enough, to the invasion of Iraq, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. That said, I do think the invasion of Afghanistan was the right thing to do in response to 9/11. And I speak as someone who's lived in Afghanistan and loves that country. But when al-Qaeda launched an attack, you remember they wanted to have 10 airliners banging into buildings across the country. I think as a nation, we were correct in responding to it. You had to say, no, that has to stop. Al-Qaeda can't use Afghanistan as a base to attack us. The Afghan war since then is problematic.
Yeah.
But there are sometimes, I'm not a pacifist.
Oh, no,
I hate war. I think there are reasons to use military force sometimes.
Yeah, I kind of agree with the Afghanistan piece, but Somalia is turning into a mess. Do you think that's going to be an al-Qaeda base? I don't know if that may not be your expertise, but I read a lot of this stuff on the web, from journals and stuff, and I'm just curious as to is if, like, these people can hop from place to place to place, and are we going to just chase them around forever?
Well, these are so-called ungoverned spaces.
Yeah.
Somalia, parts of Sudan, parts of Yemen, parts of Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. These are the places, because there is no government, where al-Qaeda has found it easy to move in. Al-Qaeda has been on the Afghan-Pakistan border now for 20 years. It struck me recently when I saw somebody say that al-Qaeda is more at home on the Afghan-Pakistan border than the Pakistan military.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Can I ask you one other question? It's curious, because if you go back to, like, the mentality in Vietnam was post-Korea and post-World War II, where some of the older officers and, like the leaders, the four-star generals and stuff, were actually World War II veterans or Korean War veterans, where you had much more deliberate use of the military. Where we, like in Cambodia, they would bomb their, holy crap out of that place in Laos, and basically dropping them in the jungle, as they used to say, and, probably caused the Khmer Rouge later on. I mean, I don't know if that's a direct correlation or not. But I'm wondering if now with all the smart munitions, there's always this seems to be like a political element to every kind of attack. And you were talking earlier about these military units had to fight their way to their posts because there was so much resistance. And it's interesting that they don't use large scale. They use precision munitions and special operations and small units and maybe some larger units. Like during the invasion, you had this overrunning larger units. But it's interesting that there's almost a fear to use extreme force, like to take out entire villages and stuff.
Well, I think and it's a correct fear. And it was a lesson that I think wasn't entirely learned until fairly late in the war in Iraq. I begin the book by talking about the Haditha massacre. The Marines in Haditha killed 24 Iraqi civilians and didn't consider it significant enough to report it up the chain of command. It was not in the formal what they call the SIGAX reports. Fallujah, second Fallujah in the fall of 2004 was extremely violent. I think probably the most violent U.S. action since the probably the Battle of Way City in Vietnam. But you're correct to point out that we have a very different military today. It's small, it's professional, and at this point is extremely seasoned. You'll see, you'll go into a unit, and all these guys, except the very new guys, are wearing combat patches. They're on their second, third, fourth rotation into Iraq and Afghanistan. They really know their business. And one thing they've learned the hard way is it's good to shoot accurately, but it's bad to shoot the wrong person accurately. And so there's, I think, a real care, generally a care about the use of force that you didn't used to see.
Yeah. We're at a midpoint here, and I'd like to introduce again our guest and go on to another caller. Thomas Ricks is the senior Pentagon correspondent at the Washington Post, where he's covered the U.S. military since 2000. He's author of the book Fiasco, which looks at the mistakes made by the United States going into Iraq, and his new book, The Gamble. The subtitle is General David Petraeus in the American Military Adventure in Iraq 2006 to 2008, which looks at this policy known as the Surge. It's published by Penguin Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next up is someone here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Juan Cole was in town. He was also on this show, and he had just seen your interview on, I guess you were on CNN. I think I heard you on Diane Rehm or something as well. I regret to regrettably agree with you in some ways. I think I don't think that we should stay. I agree with your idea that there is a moral problem in just going, but I don't see that we're actually doing the good that you see. I'm afraid, and in the way of a specific question, I'm just flabbergasted that there is no comment on the fact that to get the Standards of Forces Agreement through the Parliament, and maybe we just don't pay attention much to what Parliament say or do, had to agree to a nationwide referendum, which is scheduled for this June. It seems to me that, we can argue whether the Iraqis want us to stay, et cetera, but if this plebiscite is allowed to go ahead, which I think is questionable, that we will then see what the Iraqis want, and I think we should listen to them then. And I think there's a fair chance that they would say, "This is our country. We know it's going to be difficult, but you've done enough damage. Please go."
Let me tell you the good I think that American forces are doing there now. I think the American military presence in Iraq is the glue holding the situation together, or to use another image, it's keeping the lid on. Nobody likes us there particularly. Nobody wants us there in the long term, but nobody really wants us to leave right now. This is brought home to me in the book. There's an exchange between a former insurgent, one of these guys that came on the American payroll in Bakuba, and an American soldier. The soldier says, "So, do you still want to kill me?" And the former insurgent looks at him and says, "Yes, but not today." And that's kind of where we are in Iraq. Look, I don't think the long-term outcome is going to be anything that looks like victory to us. I think the long-term, the best, is going to be something that's going to make us uncomfortable. In the short term, though, I think of something that somebody else in the book said to me one day: just because you invade a country stupidly doesn't mean you should leave it stupidly. So the question is, what can we do there right now to mitigate the situation, to make it better, and to not condemn Iraqis to an awful fate? My worry about this plebiscite is, what if 60% of Iraqis say leave immediately, and 40% say if you leave right now, you're condemning us to death?
I wonder who you talk to. I really do. I mean, I've heard you say it so many times that nobody in Iraq that you talk to thinks that we should get out. I just wonder who you talk to. Do you really talk to the widespread? I mean, the polls don't back you up, actually, frankly. The polls say that a majority of Iraqis do want the U.S. out. I mean, obviously, polling in Iraq is problematic, as been illustrated just by the death. The death figures have never been really credibly figured out.
I'll tell you about an exchange. I can't remember whether it's in the book or not, but it's something that's really struck me in Iraq one day. An American was telling me about negotiating with Muqtada al-Sadr's people about whether to hold negotiations with them. And the Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical Shiite leader, very anti-American, his people said, before we can sit down for talks, we need a date certain from you about when you're going to leave Iraq. And the Americans at this point, this is before the Status of Forces Agreement, the Americans said, no, we can't, as a matter of national policy, we're not going to give you a date certain. And Sadr's people said, well, then we can't hold the talks. And the Americans said, okay, sorry about that. But just out of curiosity, what date did you have in mind? And Sadr's people said, you must leave Iraq by the year 2013. Well, the Americans were flabbergasted. They said that would put you at the extreme conservative wing of the U.S. Congress. So what people say in Iraq publicly and what they privately want are often two very different things, because it's a very complex game right there played right now, with a lot of people fearing for their eventual survival.
I want to again jump in here, and I want to thank the caller, and I also want to invite other people. If they want to join the conversation, we'd like to bring in some others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have about 20 minutes left talking in this hour with Tom Ricks. He's a senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, and over the last few years has made a major focus of his work the war in Iraq. His books include The Gamble, which is the new one, and the one before that, Fiasco. The president has talked about removing some significant number of troops this summer, talking about non-combat troops. And I think one of the comments you've made is, well, there is no such thing as non-combat troops. But having said that, he's talking about having all non-combat troops out within 16 months and then maybe at some point not all that long in the future, actually saying, okay, everybody is going to be out of Iraq. You just seem to feel, and the people that you talk to, particularly people in the military, seem to feel that that's just these kind of targets, and the idea that even by, you know, the year 2015, that there would be no Americans in Iraq is just not realistic.
I don't think it is realistic, but even the terms he's using are not realistic. They say it'll be non-combat troops. Well, it actually, the core of the U.S. presence during the quote-unquote non-combat troops will be two U.S. combat brigades with actually additional forces on top of that. They're going to call them advisory brigades. These are combat units. And when I hear Obama talk about this, we'll make this a non-combat mission, I think of the mission accomplished banner that his predecessor hung up. It doesn't matter whether you hang up a banner. It doesn't matter if you call it a non-combat. Troops are going to be there, and they're going to be fighting and dying. Now, will they be there after the Status of Forces Agreement? I don't know. I think so. I can't prove it, obviously, until it happens. But one of the persistent flaws in the American approach to Iraq has been over-optimism, unwarranted optimism. And I think by Obama talking about getting out quickly next year, he is not departing from President Bush. He's repeating President Bush. Remember, Bush didn't invade Iraq and say, I've got a great idea, let's go in and get stuck for 10 years. Bush's idea was, let's go in and get out quickly. The original American war plan was to get down to 30,000 troops by the fall of 2003. Well, here we are more than 4 years later, more than 5 years later, with about four times the number of troops. The other thing is Obama isn't talking about getting many troops out this year. 12,000 troops is the plan for this year, to go down to about 130,000, which is about the average for the last 5 years. So he's had the opportunity. He's come into office, and he's actually flinched and said, no, I'm not going to do what I promised on the campaign trail. So he's already thrown one major promise overboard. I wouldn't be surprised to see additional promises broken down the road.
Mm. I know that in some of the talks that you've done about the subject that you have said that you wouldn't claim to be an expert on the politics of Iraq. Your thing is military policy.
Yeah, I don't speak
policy.
Arabic. I speak military.
But having said that, based on the kind of things that you've seen and the people you've talked to, on these difficult questions like what is going to be the relationship between the major groups in the country and within the Shiite community, where is the power going to reside and what's the role going to be of Iran? I think that a lot of people early on, in fact, said there's really no alternative to here to some kind of partition, either de jure or de facto. And it seems that what we maybe are moving in the direction of a kind of de facto partition. Do you think that that's what's likely to happen?
I don't think so, for this one reason, which is I have never come across any Iraqis who like the idea. It's been more something that Americans have talked about, kind of in frustration. Joe Biden, before he became vice president, used to advocate it. I haven't heard him mention it since he moved to the White House. It would be a failure on our part. It would actually break a promise that the Americans made to the rest of the Middle East when we invaded Iraq, that we would hold the country together. It would not break up. If the country breaks up into component parts, you're probably going to see heavy intervention by all the neighboring countries. Turkey has vowed it will not have an independent Kurdistan on its doorstep. Iran already is extremely influential inside Iraq. I would say the biggest winner in the war so far. And its influence is going to be very big, especially in the south, which would lead in turn, I think, to Saudi, Jordanian, and Egyptian intervention to bolster the Sunnis. And so what then becomes a breakup of the country could very quickly lead to armed confrontation and even a regional war.
If as you have argued that if you can find some success in the surge, it did have to do with this policy of moving out from their bases and of the soldiers getting out in and among the people, establishing relationships, and so forth. If now we are what we're talking about, it may be withdrawing a small number of troops, but we're going to start to talk about pulling back. And it's something I think in a talk you said it's kind of like a reverse surge.
Yeah, next year you're going to look. They're basically planning under the current plan to take out 10,000 troops a month for the first 7 months of next year.
So what does that do to our ability to continue this one aspect of the policy that seems to have been successful? If we have fewer troops, will we be able to continue to keep doing what we're doing now that you, and I think some people would argue, has been a good thing?
No, we won't be able to do it. I mean, the American commanders will tell you flatly, it takes a lot of troops to be out there protecting the people. Now, the American hope is that Iraqi forces can take over that mission. So there will still be this stance of protection, of being in among the people. The question, of course, is can Iraqi troops do it? In the past, they have not been able to do so. They weren't trusted. Some of them, especially the Iraqi National Police, were bitterly distrusted by the Sunnis, who described them as a militia, a death squad in uniform. So are Iraqi troops better? American commanders tell you, yes, they are. But American commanders have told us that in the past and then been embarrassed. I hope they are, but in the end of the book, I quoted a lot of advisors who know these Iraqi commanders well. These are American officers who spent a year working with them and intimately in conversations late at night. Will tell you that there are a lot of little Saddams in the Iraqi military in the uniforms of the army and police, and that when we're not around, when we don't have troops to watch them, that they will revert back to Saddam's ways of behaving. And the difference is we will have organized and armed and equipped these Iraqi police officers and army officers.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Thomas Ricks. He's a senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, where he's covered the U.S. military since 2000. Before that, he had the same beat at The Wall Street Journal, where he worked for 17 years. He's a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting. His books include Fiasco, and the new one is The Gamble, General David Petraeus, and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. It's published by the Penguin Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone in Champaign to talk with next, line one. Hello?
Yes, sir, Mr. Ricks. I've read your Fiasco, but I'm a little frustrated. I get frustrated when I hear all these, quote, experts bloviate about this matter. My question to you, if President Obama has been doing it right with close consultation with his military commanders and his DOD, what is your prescription as to how we mitigate our or minimize our presence in Iraq, as you say, not leave recklessly as we went in, but at some point in time in terms of preserving our troops and our treasure, we have to call it quits. Wouldn't you agree?
No.
So how would you, if President Obama would call you over to the White House today, what would you tell them about the prudent thing to do in disengaging from Iraq in the interest of the United States of America?
I would say what I say at the end of the book, which is that it's good to get your troop numbers down. Right now, we're dangerously close to breaking our military. If you can get down to 35,000 to 50,000 troops, which, by the way, was the plan in Baghdad last summer, it was not something that President Obama just cooked up. If you can get down to 35,000 to 50,000 troops, the U.S. military can do that without breaking a sweat for several years in Iraq. It's much easier on the force. But once you get down to that number, you're probably going to have that number there for some time. In fact, General Odierno, now the top U.S. commander in Iraq, says in the book that he would like to see 35,000 troops in Iraq in the year 2015, which would make Obama's war in Iraq longer than Bush's war.
Well, I find it incredible to think that we will be in Iraq after all the time, money, and men and women we've lost, and with the budget constraints we have on ourselves in Iraq in 2015. I don't understand the strategic advantage and any other advantage of staying in Iraq to 2015.
This is one of the points of the book, is the failure of American imagination. Paul Wolfowitz was one of the Iraq hawks. He was Deputy Secretary of Defense back during the invasion. He used to use the phrase, hard to imagine. It was hard to imagine, he said, that you'd need more troops to occupy Iraq than to invade it. Hard to imagine that Iraqis couldn't pay for reconstruction with their oil revenue. I think collectively, we as a nation haven't imagined just what a mess Iraq is, just how big a disaster this is for us, and how much more blood, treasure, sweat, and tears we have to pay because of this awful decision.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you. And in fact, I think you've said that you're concerned that that the American people somehow think things are going better in Iraq than they are.
Yeah, I think the theme of Fiasco was this war is much worse shaped than you think. The theme of this new book, The Gamble, is it's not as good as you think. The war is not over, first of all. The war has changed, but it's changed several times. And we are more stuck than Americans realize. Americans have stopped paying attention to Iraq, but that doesn't mean it's over. Just because you walk out of a movie doesn't mean it ends.
You know, I think that there were some people who at one point in the last presidential contest that there were some people who thought that maybe a key issue or the key issue would be Iraq, Afghanistan, would be that part of foreign policy. And, of course, what happened was that the economic crisis came along and eclipsed that. And that seems to be now the thing that was uppermost in people's minds. Now, that's not saying that Iraq didn't play any role. What did you think, though, that Iraq did in fact play a significant role in the last presidential contest?
I think it played a pretty significant role, but as you say, it diminished with the passage of time. I do worry that a lot of people voted for Obama thinking he would get us out of Iraq quickly. And I don't think that's going to happen. And I think there will be a lot of disappointment with him because of that. Now, as I said, I got a lot of sympathy for this guy. He's got a terrible situation on his hands. I worry also, though, that his over-optimism about Iraq will hurt him also in Afghanistan, because his notion is, let's get troops out of Iraq so we can use them in Afghanistan, which means if his plan for Iraq doesn't work, then he's got trouble in both wars because he's not going to have the resources that he hoped to have for Afghanistan.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Hi. I just have a real basic question. I've been listening to various reports, and it sounds like people use the Taliban and Al-Qaeda as interchangeable, and I'm just wondering, what is the definition of each of those words? I also just wanted to make a point, too, that people that listen to alternative radio sources do not have a very glorified vision of what's going on over there. So if people would get into other media sources, they might have a little more of an idea. But I'll get off and listen to your answer. Thanks.
All right.
Taliban and Al-Qaeda is a very big question. In very rough terms, Taliban is Afghans who advocated Islamic extremist rule in Afghanistan. Frequently tribal-based and rural, especially in southern and eastern Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda is an international terrorist organization that also advocates Islamic extremism, and that's been the commonality of interest. That's why Al-Qaeda was welcomed by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now, it's interesting you should ask that, because I think you're going to see American policy under Obama and under General Petraeus, who's now the commander for the Middle East, in Afghanistan, will try to split off parts of the Taliban that are not so extreme, that are in some ways deemed reconcilable to an American presence, so people you can find some sort of common interest with. Does that answer the question?
I hope that the caller rang off, so I hope that it does. We have a couple of minutes left here. Our guest is Thomas Ricks. He's a senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. I gather that you figure that sometime in the future, it may be another, I don't know, who knows how many years, but that you will write a third book about Iraq. Do you anticipate that that will be the wind-up book, or can you even think of a time, you know, by, say, 2020, maybe, that you could actually be in a position to write such a book?
Yeah, that would be the time frame. I would hope to write a third book 10 to 15 years from now. Although Ambassador Crocker one day grimly warned me, he said, I don't know what you call a five-book series, but you better be prepared to write one of those.
Hmm. You know, some of the figures here, I think, are really interesting people. And in fact, you know, we've talked about the fact that maybe the idea for the surge came from General Odierno, and he was motivated, it sounds like, in large part by not wanting to be have the label hung around his neck, the guy who lost Iraq. Things were going badly. He didn't want it to be on his watch. So he came up with this idea, and it was certainly supported by General Petraeus. But what's interesting, I think, about a lot of these people is just how different they are, their experience, their mindset, particularly Petraeus and some of the people that he has chosen to be his closest advisors, from other career military people.
Yeah, you mean the last caller mentioned listen to alternative radio. That's kind of what they did in Iraq. They started listening to other voices. And this is an important point. The surge was as much about talking and listening as it was about fighting. And that's really brought home by the advisors that Petraeus and Odierno brought in. The three top advisors, or three of the top advisors, were foreigners. David Kilcullen, an Australian infantryman turned anthropologist, and Saadi Othman, a Palestinian-American who was educated by Mennonites, a bit of a pacifist. And then the third, perhaps most significantly, was Odierno's political advisor, a little British woman named Emma Skye. And Emma is anti-American, anti-military, and a pacifist, and an expert on the Middle East. This was a very different group of people advising the Americans than what you'd had in previous years. There was a new American humility, a willingness to listen to others, to believe that the American way was not the only way, and in fact the Iraqi way was going to be the best way to find a sustainable answer. Really, what happened in 07 was, I think, the dissidents took over the war.
And this was, to be clear, that, as you said in the beginning, that when this plan was floated, it was put out there, the idea of the surge, that almost everybody in the Pentagon was against it.
Yeah, and people out in Baghdad in the spring of 07 felt that they were still against it, that the Pentagon was not supporting them on this, that Admiral Fallon, the commander for the Middle East at that time, was trying to undercut them. There was a lot of opposition inside the U.S. military to this, and a lot of people, even in Baghdad, who thought it was going to fail. I remember in the spring of 07 asking people, what are the chances of this thing working, even tactically, in just improving security? And I get answers like 10%, 20%, 30%. But there was a lot of gloom and pessimism going into this. I didn't think the surge was going to work because I didn't think that the American military that I'd seen in Iraq was capable of carrying out this very different sort of mission.
Well, we'll have to leave the program there. It's just about completed. This is an archive that we first broadcast in March, conversation with Tom Ricks, senior Pentagon correspondent with The Washington Post. His book, The Gamble, it's out in bookstores now. And if you'd like to, again, hear the rest of the interview, you can go to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. Programs here on WILL made possible with support from Lincoln Square, starting as one of the nation's first enclosed malls. Lincoln Square now evolved into a mixed-use lifestyle center, information, business space, and future development projects available at 217-367-4092. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of U of I alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. We'll break for an update in the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And with a look at the numbers now, July wheat in Kansas City at $6.92 and a quarter, up 17 and a quarter. September at $7.75, up 15. And December at $7.17 and three quarters, up 16. July wheat in Chicago at $6.40 and three quarters, up 15. September at $6.66 and three quarters, up 15. And December at $6.89 and a half, up 15 and a quarter. July corn, $4.31 and a quarter, up 5 and a quarter. September, $4.40.